Thanks, Andrew. And I too would like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. And also remind you that when you hear those acknowledgements of country, just put in your mind that Indigenous Australians have a life expectancy of about a decade shorter than non-Indigenous Australians, and so those acknowledgements are not something of the past, they're something of the present. So I like to start by going back to Porter and Ticeberg, who wrote the book on redefining healthcare and regenerated about a decade or so ago this interest in value-based competition. And they said that basically the way to transform the health industry is to realign competition so it's based on value for patients, not just cost. They invented or propagated this with a very famous and simple equation that value for patients is equal to outcomes divided by cost. So both are relevant, but what we're talking about is patient-based outcomes. They then went along and proposed a hierarchy of outcomes that they thought were relevant, this is from a later paper than their book, and that focus on things like the outcomes of care and things like other aspects or other attributes of outcome-oriented care. Most importantly, they talk about health status as the tier one outcome, but they also talk about other aspects of care, including, and I can't read this, but I hope you can, the time for care, the waiting time, and so on. Their principles, or what they called their principles of value-based competition, there were eight of them. But, you know, obviously they start with the focus should be on value for patients, not just lowering cost. Competition must be based on the results, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, these things are actually a mix of aspirations and principles and things like, you know, high quality should be less costly. That's not a principle, that's an aspiration, I think. But if you look at it, there are a number of elements here that we want to focus on, that competition must be based on the results. And that implicitly means that you actually must measure the results and you actually must publish those results so you can actually start to compete. So the results information have to be widely available. So if we are to move towards value-based competition, we must collect results, we must make the results information available, and importantly, we have some information of that kind available now, but we need more. So, you know, just in the last, a month or so ago, there was this famous debate about out-of-pocket costs. There's a saintly surgeon who charges the earth for cancer operations. And yes, it's worth it, but not, there is not a single piece of information in the public domain about the outcomes from that surgeon. Not a single piece. And of course, the patients feel like he must be good, because he charges so much, and they have no information about whether that is fair or not, but he's a saint. So basically the principle here is if empowered consumers choose, or their GPs recommend, surgeons with better quality, including lower complication rates and lower pockets, both consumers and private health insurers or funders actually benefit. And we do nothing in our system to do this. I don't know whether you know, but again, a couple of weeks ago, the AMA released an information guide for patients. I don't know whether you still have paper sort of documents in your organisations, but this was a paper document, and 10 or 20 pages. Leanne actually endorsed it for some reason. And what was interesting is that it essentially implies that the patient is able to drive all this and force the doctor to give them information, and the doctor will give them information not only about the doctor's fees, the surgeon's fees, but also the assistant surgeon, the anaesthetist, the pathologist, the radiologist, the physician who might come and look after them and so on. Of course, none of that is happening and none of it is true, but basically this is what we need to be thinking about. And that's where I think we need to go. Now, it is a current fad. There's lots and lots of discussion about it, but it's also interesting to look at other processes, and one is lean. And the fundamental premise for all lean organisations and the first step in any lean undertaking is to identify the cost of customer and what the customer values. So the ideas behind value-based competition are not new. In fact, yesterday morning I went to a breakfast which was headed value-based healthcare, and the guy didn't mention that term once in his presentation because he was talking about lean and the patient journey and improving the patient journey. So it's exactly the same principle. So we've got to be careful with terms like value-based care, because it's essentially what Kieran Walsh calls a pseudo-innovation. That is, it's, you know, repackaging of an old idea. That's not to say the old idea is a bad thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing. But rather, we've got to be careful that this marketing approach is not just another mechanism to transfer money from healthcare organisations to consultancies rather than actually do something sensible and improve care. So the question, obviously, is, does value-based care have something to offer, and is it a fad or fabulous? Now, oh dear, my transition is not working. So behind that, not what we think the autumn, behind that slide, I've got that three tiers. And the first tier is about an emphasis on PROMs, patient-reported outcomes, is obviously welcomed. We should be doing that. We should be doing much more of it. And in fact, Porter and Tiesberg said, outcome measurement is the single most important tool to drive innovation in healthcare. Every provider can begin to measure their outcomes hierarchy in the medical conditions it services and to track its progress. Absolutely, I agree with that, and absolutely that's what every healthcare organisation ought to be doing. And remember here, we're talking about outcomes that matter to patients, not outcomes that matter to clinicians, not outcomes that matter to funders, but outcomes that matter to patients. So, George Faithful is in the room and he's seen this slide before, but this is a slide from the Joint Registry. And it's about the number of procedures on the vertical axis, and I've divided the surgeons involved, the orthopaedic surgeons involved, into those who, by and large, for 90% of their cases, choose just two hip prostheses. And into others who are more diverse, you know, 70 to 90% just choosing two hip prostheses, and less than 70 with two hip prostheses. So that's what the columns are. But the dark part of that is, so we know, we can measure which hip prostheses are the best performing in terms of revision rates. There's quite a variation in revision rates of hip prostheses, from 2-ish percent to 8-ish percent over a 5-year period. And so there's some that are better and some that are worse. You can rank them in better to worse. So which surgeons only select their prostheses from the best performing, that is, that have the lowest revision rate? 3/4 or so of all hip prostheses that are used in this country are not in the best performing. So the question then is, I can understand the conversation with the orthopaedic surgeon. So, you know, come and sit down, Mr. or Mrs. Bloggs. We're going to use we're going to put a special hip prosthesis in you. Look, I'm just letting you know it has 4 times the revision rate, but that's okay with you, isn't it? Can you imagine that conversation going on? What sort of informed consent is going on about the choice of hip prosthesis? Probably none. And yet this information is there. In my view, it is unethical for an orthopaedic surgeon to not have that conversation and to not be choosing the best value from an outcome that the patient probably thinks is important. The second part of the tier is waiting times, obviously important. Another part of the tier is an emphasis on low value and ineffective care, and an emphasis on complications and adverse events, which obviously add to cost. So look at low value care. This is looking at four procedures here. And measuring low-value care can be a bit tricky, and so basically the research now says, well, is it the narrow definition of value of low-value or the broader definition? Whether you use the narrow definition or the broader definition, there's more low-value care in the private sector than there is in the public sector, as you would expect, and in some cases it's hugely different. So what are we doing? How are we empowering, for example, private health insurers to address that problem? At the moment, no one is addressing the problem. Obviously, if we're thinking about value-based care, healthcare, thinking about low value and ineffective care is really good. So I've spoken so far about outcomes, I haven't spoken about cost. Incorporating cost into the whole process may be tricky and create unrealistic expectations. That's sort of a conclusion from a study of the implementation of value-based healthcare in Sweden, I think. But this is, quite an interesting schematic for helping us to think about low-valued care. Low-value healthcare has a number of components to it. One is ineffective care, care that's essentially useless. One is inefficient care, patients staying too long or whatever. And one is unwanted care, that is not thinking about what the patient actually wanted from their care. And the solutions, helpfully alliterative, limit, lean or listen. And often with value-based healthcare, our discussions with value-based healthcare concentrate on the last element of that, just listening to the patient about what the patient values in their outcomes, rather than thinking about all three of those. Of course, the last one probably challenges hierarchy and power and stakeholder interests less than the first two, but it's a useful framework and useful to not forget that we need to think about all three. Obviously, who's responsible for dealing with, if we look at that framework, who's responsible for dealing with it? Well, obviously, in the listening, each provider needs to listen. Each hospital, each doctor, each community health service needs to listen to make sure that what they're providing is, in fact, what the patient actually wants. That the patient goes in with back pain. What needs to be addressed is back pain, not just giving more surgery. Similarly, with inefficient care, it's partly the responsibility of the provider, but it's also responsibility of the funder to actually design the funding system to give an incentive to the provider to worry about inefficient care. Ineffective care is a bit more complicated, again, responsibility of the provider, again, a responsibility of the funder, but it might also be the responsibility of the Commonwealth Government, for example. We had the MBS review, which was designed... I've got to be careful how I phrase this. The MBS review was a process which involved looking at low-value care and thinking about changes to the MBS items to address that. But, of course, when you think about whether that was a useful process or not, again, it emphasises the importance of looking at it, of thinking about value from whose perspective. If you just think of it narrowly from the taxpayer's perspective, it was a complete waste of space. But if you look at it from McKinsey's perspective, it was a very, very valuable exercise. So it's not necessarily a good way of going. But you might also say the Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare has a critical role in designating areas of ineffective care, and so too does APRA, the regulator. So what's interesting about the Porter and Theisberg framework is that patient experience is actually not an outcome. Now, think about it. They're saying, and I can understand why they say that, but it's not something I agree with. That is, I think we need to be worried about the patient experience as well as the outcomes. They're not alternatives. They are in addition to. So my view is value is not only about the patient-reported outcome and cost, but it's also about the patient experience. But then you think, well, of course, this is a book and an idea that came from the United States. So of course it doesn't think about equity, for example. It's just not a word that is ever used in discourse in the United States. So my view is that when we're thinking about value, we have to be a bit more complex and think about equity issues. We also need to think about societal-related outcomes. Healthcare is not only about individual treatment. Healthcare has issues about creating social solidarity, teaching, and all sorts of other things that aren't actually in that value equation out of Porter and Theisberg. So we've got to be very careful when we're looking at this that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'll skip that, which is about a PhD thesis someone wrote. So when we're thinking about value-based care, we've got to actually think about from whose perspective? And that's the message I'd like to leave with you. Some of this is in a paper that I've published recently. Thanks very much.